welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for October 23rd, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, fixing a climate accounting error, a pathogenic threat to frogs, and big telescope plans. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how trust is only skin deep from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by American Journal Experts, the number one source for science and medical paper editing and proofreading. AJE has over 700 native English-speaking editors in various fields of study. They have helped tens of thousands of authors worldwide. Quality and customer satisfaction are their highest priorities. www.journalexperts.com. Use referral code SCIENCE to receive a 10% discount.
Under the Kyoto Protocol, participating countries must meet their targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. According to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, these amount to an average of 5% against 1990 levels over the five-year period 2008 to 2012. One of the ways countries can meet their targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions is through market-based mechanisms, including emissions trading, otherwise known as the carbon market. But in a policy forum in this week's Science, Steve Hamburg and colleagues argue that the accounting needed for such a market and used for assessing compliance with carbon limits in the Kyoto Protocol contains a fixable but critical error that will undermine greenhouse gas reduction goals. The authors write that the effect of the accounting error means, for example, the clearing of long-established forests to burn wood or to grow energy crops is counted as a 100% reduction in energy emissions, despite causing large releases of carbon. I spoke with Hamburg from New Jersey, where his organization, the Environmental Defense Fund, is having its annual retreat this week.
Well, there is an assumption that's made in the UNFCCC, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, that we need to account for all carbon globally. And under that, there's a reporting requirement for the signatory countries, which is largely all the countries of the globe, that they will be reporting land use emissions in the aggregate and fossil fuel emissions in the aggregate. And for bioenergy, that could be counted on either side because they're generated on the land side. They're burned in the combustion engines that would be generally, for the most part, using fossil energy. And so the UNFCCC makes bioenergy accounted for on the land side and not on the combustion side, which is fine. But when one goes to a regulatory framework, as the Kyoto Protocol requires, there are not land use accounting requirements because technically that is quite difficult to do, very difficult to do, and of course politically also complicated. So we only include under any kind of cap the fossil fuel combustion side of that global accounting. And in making the assumption that the accounting for bioenergy is handled on the land use side, but in a situation now where we're not counting the land use side, we have missed those emissions and thus are not accurately accounting for the total emissions associated with anthropogenic activity.
So the implicit incentive then is to...
Well, we need to ensure that the incentives for using bioenergy are directly tied to their advantages if any particular fuel has on reducing the total emissions of carbon to the atmosphere. And those are going to be activity-based. For example, if we are harvesting a forest and currently only doing stem-only harvesting, which means we're just taking the bole and converting it into 2x4s or veneer or other physical products, you could be leaving maybe 30% of the biomass on site on top of the forest floor, and that material would decompose and go back to the atmosphere. Instead of allowing it to stay on site, that material could be chipped and could be burned, and then we are reducing emissions on the forest floor, and thus the ones that are coming from the combustion engine are offsetting. And then we've displaced fossil fuel, and we truly have reduced the net emissions to the atmosphere because we've reduced them on the forest floor, and they're the same in the combustion of the biomass as they were with fossil fuel, and the net is that we have reduced emissions. We can do that also by increasing productivity on, we'll say, marginal landscapes, soils that have been degraded, and that maybe by doing best practices, we can increase the productivity, increase the amount of carbon that is fixed on those lands, and that additional carbon can then be counted as a credit against the emissions that are coming from the combustion of the material that's grown in that site. And that is truly additional. The key is that we have to ensure that the bioenergy is utilizing additional carbon or reducing emissions from another source and utilizing that activity to displace the fossil fuel.
Any way to tell if those effects have happened in the years since the Kyoto Protocol on climate change was adopted?
When you say those effects, you mean incentivizing?
That incentive, yes.
Well, we're still early in, because there isn't a cap in the U.S., and so in the European Union, certainly, there's these kinds of pressures to use bioenergy are there, and I'm not an expert on the European Union fuel use. And you're seeing it in the legislation and the incentives that are being in the process being put through in California and elsewhere to say that we want to use more renewable energy and biofuels. Bioenergy is one source of them. It is in some cases, and what we need to do is differentiate among those activities that generate those bioenergies, the ones that are truly additional and the ones that are not. And we still may do those other activities, but they don't deserve carbon credit under any kind of legal framework because they're not benefiting the atmosphere.
So the fly itself then has spread from the Kyoto Protocol to other countries, the European Union, it sounds like.
Right. And currently, the current climate bill in the House includes that as well.
Why did it take so long to identify this fly?
Well, it's one of those things that I was a member of the IPCC Special Report on Land Use Change in Forestry that was published in 2000. I was a lead author. And as we were thinking about the implications of land use and forestry management as it relates to the Kyoto Protocol, on a very long time frame, one can think of these things as in balance, so that if we cut that forest down, the carbon will be replaced over the rotation length. The problem is the time interval that it takes. So it's going to take 80 or 100 years to get that balance, which is a very long time when we think about carbon budgets. And so we sort of made a sweep of a hand. It had worked under the UNFCC. It was correct. And it was just one of those things. We just, nobody sort of did the critical thinking. And, you know, we all said, yeah, it's roughly right. It's just the problem is it's not. And these things happen. And that's why science is a process of iteration and correction. There was no deliberate problem. It was just, there was momentum, and we needed collectively as a community to sit down and look back to our basic assumptions to realize we had made an error.
Would the whole community agree with you? Are there groups or countries who would say, no, this accounting of bioenergy is perfectly valid?
I think that once one discusses it from a physical carbon balance, carbon cycle perspective, I believe, no, that others could not disagree that there is only one way to look at the amount of carbon. There are multiple ways to address the error, but the net carbon emissions is a physical science problem, not a political problem. And I do believe that, and that's why we have many co-authors on the paper, that this is something that most, when they look at it critically, will realize that we're correct.
You said there are a number of ways to address the error. The hope then is to fix it for the upcoming climate conference in Copenhagen?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm going to leave that. That's not a sort of science question. You know, I think what we need to do is we need to head to a solution and ensure that the incentives get fixed. The timeline for doing that is one that's going to be decided by the political process. There's a whole series of inputs, but it's not something we can put off for the duration. And at EDF, Environmental Defense Fund, we are involved in actually developing a stakeholder process with the various communities that make the fuels and burn the fuels to begin to explore what those options are and try and understand the multiple perspectives and ensure that we come up with something that is scientifically sound, but it also addresses the real social and political needs of a community that's made investments and there have been assumptions.
You said it's not a science question. This is a policy form that your team
right.
has written.
But it's the science bleeds over, and then I think the key for the policy form here is that we are saying here's a problem, it needs a fix, but then we need another suite of people, right? The folks who wrote it were scientists who can deal with the carbon. You know, should it be addressed? Absolutely. But there are multiple ways to fix it, and it's not, the science doesn't discriminate among those ways of fixing it. Where the credit should be assigned, how does one get credit? We know that we need to assign the credit according to the net emissions. But then how you assign credit is really a political economy question.
Steve Hamburg, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Steve Hamburg of the Environmental Defense Fund is co-corresponding author of a policy forum titled Fixing a Critical Climate Accounting Error. Find the paper and a related news story in this week's Science. Online at www.scienceexpress.org, you can also read a related report that asks how important indirect emissions are from biofuels. Fungal infections are rarely fatal if they are confined to the skin. But if it's an amphibian skin, which absorbs water, oxygen, and electrolytes, a fungal infection is much more serious and can kill. For decades now, such a pathogenic fungus has been spreading among amphibians around the world, causing population crashes in many species. And now, in a paper in this week's Science, Jamie Voiles and colleagues report on how the disease, called chytridiomycosis, leads to an imbalance in electrolytes, which, in turn, leads to cardiac arrest and death. I spoke with Voiles from Australia, where she studies disease ecology at James Cook University, Townsville.
So our paper, and this very much was a team effort, was focusing on figuring out how this fungus kills frogs. And this was really a bit of a mystery because the fungus only infects the most superficial layers of skin. So we conducted a series of experiments designed to test the functioning of frog skin. And we also tracked physiological changes in the blood and in the urine, and we monitored their cardiac electrical functioning. And we found that the skin, which is a really important organ for frogs, because it normally regulates osmotic balance and respiratory gases and other important physiological processes, when the frogs are infected, the skin is severely impaired by the fungal infection. And as a result, frogs have reduced electrolyte levels in the blood, and we also were able to see that they suffer from asystolic cardiac arrest, which ultimately causes death. So it really looks like a series of events that is initiated by the malfunctioning in the skin, which consequently leads to electrolyte imbalance and heart problems.
Do other animals other than amphibians get this fungal pathogen?
Not that we're aware of. As far as we know, this is exclusively an amphibian disease.
Does it have the same effect, then, death, for all amphibians who are infected with it?
No, there seems to be some variation in susceptibility to the disease. So there are interspecific differences. However, that said, it really has an incredibly broad host range. So it can kill many different kinds of species from very different amphibian families.
And which amphibian did you and your team test?
We were working with a green tree frog, and its scientific name is Latoria cerulea.
How did you and your team go about figuring out how it led to death in the green tree frogs that you examined?
Yeah, we performed a series of infection experiments. And the first thing that we wanted to do was to track the infections using PCR analysis and skin biopsies. Then we also wanted to measure the functioning of the skin and take blood samples and urine samples to track physiological changes. And we also used implanted biotransmitters to monitor the electrical functioning in the heart. The last thing that we did, because we found that electrolyte abnormalities were a consistent problem for these frogs, was to provide diseased amphibians with an electrolyte supplement to see if this would reduce some of their clinical signs, which it did. Their condition improved, and they lived longer than frogs that did not receive an electrolyte supplement.
So you're pretty sure then it's low levels of electrolytes that are leading to the eventual cardiac arrest, not lack of oxygen or water transported through the skin?
Well, so our study indicates that, you know, the dysfunction in the skin is the initiating event, and the decreases in electrolytes are obviously incredibly important to the pathophysiology of this disease. And the process of elimination for understanding what caused asystolic cardiac arrest pointed to shifts in electrolytes. We were not able to get as good of measurements for things like respiratory gases. However, with the little evidence that we had from a small number of amphibians, we really were seeing that electrolyte changes in the blood. We suspect that that is really the important variable for these frogs.
Now, you said that electrolyte supplements were a treatment. Is it a cure potentially, or is that even a consideration here?
No, electrolyte supplements are not a cure. And I think it is important to make that point. The electrolyte abnormalities are important here for sure. But unless we take care of that initiating event, which is the damage to the skin, it's really just a palliative treatment. That is that it can prolong their life, but it's probably not going to be the final cure. Unless the skin damage is reversed, the electrolyte treatment is really unlikely to help the frogs to survive ultimately.
Now, you said it doesn't kill all amphibians. Are you and your team working towards finding a cure, or is this more seen as an opportunity to study natural selection, death by natural fungal pathogen?
Well, our team is certainly interested in the phenomenon of amphibian declines in general. And of course, we are extremely concerned because, you know, there is an incredible number of amphibian species that we're losing due to this disease. Our objective was not to necessarily find a cure, but to figure out the mechanisms of death so we can understand how this fungus kills frogs. These results will, you know, start us on a path to developing treatments for amphibians that can be used in a clinical setting and potentially to help in outbreaks of amphibians in the wild by being able to treat amphibians in situ. That definitely probably is a small step towards finding a cure that will, you know, eliminate the threat of extinction to amphibians. However, it's a pretty big step forward in our understanding of the disease. So understanding this disease has been challenging because we are losing amphibians so rapidly and it's affecting so many different species of frogs. So while we're trying to understand the basics of the disease, we're simultaneously trying to put in place conservation programs so that we don't lose the amphibians before we have a really good understanding of the disease. And on top of that, we're working with finite resources. So even though we've made incredible gains, we're still facing the problem of getting funding and maintaining funding for research and funding for conservation programs. And it is a very big challenge for anyone concerned with amphibian declines and specifically for the problem of chytridiomycosis.
Jamie Voiles, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Jamie Voiles of James Cook University, Townsville, is lead author of a paper on the pathogenesis of chytridiomycosis, a cause of catastrophic amphibian declines. Two different research teams are pursuing two very different telescope projects, with each team hoping theirs will become the biggest land-based telescope ever. Estimates of the cost of these projects range from $700 million for one project to $1 billion for the other, and so far, neither side is close to securing its needed funding. Now, given the recent economic downturn, you might wonder why the two teams don't join forces. In this week's science newsletter, Udit Bhattacharjee profiles both projects and both project team leaders and discovers why the chances of them joining forces are astronomical, though scientists on both teams are hoping both telescopes are built, so long as theirs gets funded first. In the article, Bhattacharjee also reports on a third land-based telescope project being planned by the European Southern Observatory that will be even larger and cost even more.
Well, this story is about the race to build the world's biggest telescope. There's two projects that the story focuses on, the 30-meter telescope, which will be built in Hawaii, if there's enough money for it, and the Giant Magellan Telescope, which will be built in Chile, if there's enough money for it. There's also a third project that the story covers, which is the European Extremely Large Telescope, which will be the biggest of them all, and that they still haven't decided where to put that telescope. and the funding for that seems a little bit rosier and more definite, but even that is going to be a big challenge to build.
What prompted the creation of a large, or in this case, several large ground-based telescope projects in the first place?
Well, astronomers want to see as much of the universe as they can. And so that, of course, is the primary driver for building bigger and better telescopes. For ground-based astronomy, the only way to see more objects in the sky and fainter objects in the sky is to build primary mirrors that are going to be so large that they will collect a lot more light than the primary mirrors of today's telescopes. And back in the late 90s, when the decadal survey was completed, this is a review that the community does every 10 years to decide what astronomy projects should be pursued. The decadal review said a top priority for U.S. astronomy would be to build a giant segmented mirror telescope, something on the order of 30, 40, 50 meters. And so since then, astronomers in the U.S. as well as in Europe have been working to develop these concepts.
How far along is each of these telescopes in being built?
Yeah, these three projects are roughly sort of at the same place right now. The 30-meter telescope has completed a full design study, and so they have a very precise understanding of exactly how to build what they're proposing. The Giant Magellan Telescope also has completed a design study, but it's currently in the middle of a detailed design study. However, the Giant Magellan Group has already cast the first of these seven mirrors, which are going to come together to make the Giant Magellan Telescope. So they actually have a physical object that is, you might say, 1/7 of the physical object that is going to be the main component of the Giant Magellan Telescope. And the European telescope, I think, doesn't have anything that concrete yet, but they do have, they're in the middle of a design study, and I think they're prepared to submit a full construction proposal to the European Southern Observatories Council next year in 2010.
How much money has each project raised? Out of how much is needed overall to build these giant telescopes?
Sure. So the 30-meter telescope, by current estimates, will cost at least $1 billion to build. And the project has secured close to $300 million so far, which is a third. They also have a commitment from Canada, which intends to contribute 25% of the cost. And they are also in talks with Japan, which may contribute some funding. The Giant Magellan Telescope so far claims to have raised nearly $200 million, including about $72 million from the Australian government. The Giant Magellan Telescope will need $700 million in all, so it's a little bit cheaper than TMT, the 30-meter telescope, going by estimates. And the European project will cost $1.5 billion, and they are assured of about a third of that cost from ESO's budget. ESO is the European Southern Observatory. So that's the funding situation.
What accounts for the differences in cost?
Well, the differences stem from the differences in technology and the equipment that will go into these telescopes. The difference between the Giant Magellan Telescope and the 30-meter telescope is that the Giant Magellan Telescope will have seven large mirrors, each 8.4 meters in diameter. Now, that's huge. And these seven mirrors together will basically span a diameter of about 24.5 meters. And so that's how big the primary mirror of the telescope will be. The 30-meter telescope will be 30 meters in diameter, but it will be made of 492 segments. About 1.4 meters each that will be joined together very precisely and will work together as one sort of contiguous surface. The European telescope will be 42 meters in size, and that will have, I think, about 1,000 segments that are about as big as the 1.4 meter segments that the 30 meter telescope will use. So there's a similarity in the primary mirror technology between the 30-meter telescope and the European telescope. And so the giant Magellan telescope, you might say, in some ways is the outlier when it comes to the primary mirror. However, the people who are building the giant Magellan telescope claim that their technology is somewhat old-fashioned for a reason, because they know exactly how to build these monoliths, these sort of single-piece mirrors, 8.4 meters. They've already made a few of these. As I said before, they've cast the first of these mirrors, and they're in the process of polishing that particular one.
What, if any, advantages does one telescope technology have over the other?
Well, one difference between the two is the adaptive optics systems. So the Giant Magellan Telescope will be able to get a wider field of view and get more detailed observations across a bigger, you know, swathe of the sky, whereas the 30-meter telescope will get more detail on point sources like stars and galaxies. And so one telescope might be better for cosmological studies, and the other one might be better for more sort of more standard astronomical discoveries. The two telescopes would also, if they both get built, would also get built in two different hemispheres. The 30-meter telescope would be in the northern hemisphere and would look at the northern sky, and the Giant Magellan Telescope would be in the southern hemisphere. So those two are sort of features that distinguish the two telescopes.
Now, you started off by saying whether these telescopes will be built, and the two teams probably each are hoping that their team will secure the funding to actually build them. I imagine the scientists want both.
Certainly, when I spoke to astronomers who are not connected to either of these projects, you know, they would love to see both of them get built. However, everyone realizes that if federal funding is to be brought to bear for these projects, then it might be difficult for the government to equally support both or put its full force behind both. So while everyone would like to see both getting built, there's no doubt that the two teams would like to first secure their own funding before wishing that the other team also gets funded. And I talk a lot about the story. In fact, the story is a profile not just of these two telescopes. It is an equal part a profile of these two very interesting characters who are leading these two projects, or leading the technologies behind these two projects, pioneers in their own right, both very competitive, both members of the National Academies of Science. So it's a very interesting dynamic between these two teams. They're both competing, and in some ways, you know, the competition might be good for both of them.
Udita Bhattacharjee, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science's Udita Bhattacharjee profiles two very different telescope projects competing to become the largest ever eye on the sky. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how trust is only skin deep. Something about attractiveness here, Dave?
Exactly, Rob. You know, it's probably not a stretch to say that attractive people tend to have an easier time in life. And that's not just anecdotal. That's actually been shown in scientific studies that attractive people are frequently judged more trustworthy and honest than less attractive people. And they seem to earn more money, too. And in this new study, the researchers wanted to see, are there other benefits of being attractive? They wanted to see if attractive people were more trusting of others if the other people knew that they were attractive.
So attractive people then are more trusting of somebody else when they know that other person can see them.
Exactly. In other words, if I think that you think that I'm attractive, then I think you're going to be more trustworthy. It's kind of a strange concept, but it all gets back to this idea of, do attractive people not only do better in society, but do they also feel that society is going to treat them better because they're attractive?
How did they test this?
Well, the researchers played this economic game with about 80 psychology students at the University of Aberdeen in the United Kingdom. And what they had those students do was they had them come in and they said, okay, you're going to play a game with an opponent. And they gave the students two options. They said, either we will give you a sort of a small pot of money and you can divide that evenly between you and your opponent, Or you can trust your opponent with a larger pot of money and have that opponent divvy up that money. And the idea is, if you really trust your opponent and you trust that opponent to divvy up the money equally, then you're going to get more money in the long run because that opponent has a bigger pot rather than you just sort of divvying up this smaller pot. And then they threw attractiveness into the equation. They had students rate themselves on attractiveness, but they also had a panel of sort of outside experts also rate these students' attractiveness. And those were actually pretty well correlated. So if the student found themselves attractive, oftentimes the outside panel would find them attractive as well. And here's what the researchers found. The most attractive people, in fact, the prettiest top third, as judged by this outside panel, were 69% more likely to trust their opponent than the people that were in the bottom third of attractiveness.
And that's enough to say it's statistically significant?
That's statistically significant. And it goes back to this idea that if people think that other people think that they're attractive, then they're going to be more trusting of those other people.
So indeed, it's not about how I feel about my own attractiveness.
No, it's really about how you feel about how others feel about your attractiveness.
Okay. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from trusting other people as they see you to seeing through walls, this next story is about using radio waves to monitor somebody's movement from behind a wall.
This doesn't sound exactly new. I mean, radar and things like that have been around for some time now.
Right, Rob, radar has been around for a long time. This is similar to radar, but it's actually a lot more versatile. With radar, you're thinking about, you know, these big devices, maybe something on a ship or in a plane that's going to help you detect objects. But with this new approach, it's really about seeing objects inside these other objects. So, for example, if you had a burglar in your house, how would you know where that burglar was in the house or where he or she was moving around if you were outside the house? Same thing if there was, say, a house fire or a building fire. Could you set something up around this building very quickly that would allow you to see if there was people trapped inside the building? And that's what this new study is about, trying to figure out if there's a way to do that. And the technology that these researchers are investigating is based on a phenomenon called multipath fading. And you may have experienced this. If you're in a room where an AM radio is playing, sometimes when people walk around the room, it can cause static on the radio. And that's because our bodies absorb radio waves. And these researchers said, well, is there a way we can actually utilize this multipath fading to our advantage? And what they did was they set up this network of pole-mounted, cell phone-sized transceivers, which send out and receive radio waves. And what they found is if they set this up, you know, in a building-like setting, they could actually follow a person moving around inside this building to an accuracy of about 1 meter.
So some sort of complicated computer algorithm then takes in all this data and sort of figures out where this multipath fading is happening. Is that it?
Exactly.
Clearly, there are applications. When are we likely to see something like this on the market?
Well, this is still in its fairly early phases, and it does have some Achilles heels. One thing is that because it's radio, its frequency can be jammed. So if you're talking about using it for home security, all a burglar would have to do was jam the signal before they went into the house. So it's still a lot of obstacles to be overcome. But what's really promising about this technology is it's very cheap. You're talking about very simple devices and very cheap devices that you would need to surround a house with. So you're not talking about something that would be as expensive as something like radar or infrared. And that makes it very promising for commercialization.
Okay. So last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from beaming radio waves through a building to beaming lasers into the brain of a fly, this last story is about creating false memories.
In flies?
In flies and potentially one day in humans.
Sounds dangerous.
Well, if you're a fly in this study, it is pretty dangerous. Here's what the study's about, Rob. You know, if you, when you're very young, you probably, or maybe, and I probably did, stuck your finger into an electrical outlet. And you probably only did that once, because once you did it and you got that shock, you never did it again. You saw an electrical outlet and you said, that is something I do not want to stick my finger into. And researchers are able to do something very similar with flies. flies tend to have a preference for certain odors. And so what researchers did was they put flies in this chamber and they pumped in one of two odors. And some flies preferred one odor and some flies preferred the other. And then what the researchers did was they did something very similar to the sticking your finger into an electrical outlet example. If a fly moved towards, say, odor A, they would shock the fly. And from then on out, or at least for a few hours, as long as the fly's memory lasts, the flies, when that odor was pumped in, the flies would run away or fly away from that odor. They would really avoid it. They would say, that odor's bad because when I smell that, I get shocked. And then the next thing the researchers did, which was really interesting, is they said, can we make flies learn their lessons about these odors without actually administering the electric shock? So in other words, to take the example back to humans, could you learn not to stick your finger into that electrical outlet without first getting that negative reinforcement of the shock? Is there a way to give the flies the memory that these odors are bad without actually having them have the painful experience first?
And they used lasers to do this?
They used lasers. What they did was they put this molecule, which is called ATP, which is a source of cellular energy, they put it in these sort of molecular cage in the fly's brain. And what the laser does is it releases ATP from this cage, and the ATP activates neurons that release dopamine, and in flies, dopamine is the signal for averse memory. So, you know, when the flies get that shock, their neurons release dopamine, and that dopamine tells the flies, your very small brain, basically, this is a bad thing. So what the researchers did is they repeated the odor experiment, but this time when the fly got near a particular odor, the researchers didn't shock them. They just zapped their brain with lasers, which doesn't hurt the fly, but it released this ATP and caused this whole cellular cascade, which basically told the fly, this odor is bad. So the fly didn't get any sort of negative shock or anything, just all of a sudden something happened in their brain that said, hey, this is a bad odor, you should avoid it.
This molecular cage with the ATP was somehow inserted beforehand.
Was inserted beforehand, exactly.
So a kind of a brain shock then?
No, it just caused a memory, but it wasn't actually a physically unpleasant experience.
I imagine it's pretty important, though, to know where to put that molecular cage with the ATP, or doesn't it matter where you inject that?
Well, the researchers, you know, played around a lot at first. They put these molecular cages in a variety of places in the fly's brain and figured out which regions were most responsive. And actually doing that helped them narrow down a region that just had 12 neurons in it that were really responsible for this learning behavior. And even though flies have very small brains or brain-like structures, they're still talking about thousands and thousands of neurons. So just to be able to narrow it down to 12 is a really important advance in its own right. But the really intriguing thing about all this study is, you know, obviously, ultimately, Rob, researchers want to know, you know, will this have any applications for humans? And one idea is, say, you're reading a Shakespeare sonnet or trying to remember something in your car manual. Could scientists do something that would help you remember that more, or potentially even giving you memories like they gave the flies that they didn't have before? It's all very interesting and very controversial stuff, but this is an interesting first step.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a couple of interesting neuroscience stories. Speaking of the brain, we're looking into a story about memories and sleepless nights. Why do our memories seem to be worse if we haven't gotten a good night's sleep? And another story about how certain cells in our ear seem to process painful sounds. So if you're at a very loud rock concert and you've got that ringing in your ears afterwards, scientists think they may have found out why that happens. And for the science policy blog, Science Insider, we're looking into a story about a former scientist who's just been accused of espionage and what's going on with that and what kind of research he was doing before he was arrested. And also swine flu, as you may have noticed, is creeping back into the news. And we've got some analysis this week about why younger people seem to be more susceptible to H1N1 than people over 65. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by American Journal Experts, the number one source for science and medical paper editing and proofreading. AJE has over 700 native English-speaking editors in various fields of study. They have helped tens of thousands of authors worldwide. Quality and customer satisfaction are their highest priorities. www.journalexperts.com. Use referral code SCIENCE to receive a 10% discount.
And that wraps up the October 23rd, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.